Welcome to Propaganda Loves You, the show where we ask and answer the question, what happened to Hitler's body? I'm Cody, your host for this week, and as always, I'm joined by Arthur and Joe.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
I never know how to start. I guess that's like the weirdest thing, because like we have the welcome to Propaganda Loves You before the music. So I guess just like, hey, welcome. So today we're going to talk about fascism again. Before we go into part two of our fascism episode, a couple of things have been happening that we wanted to talk about. One of those things is a recent addition to the White House press pool is actually Tim Pool, or someone from Tim Pool's podcast. If that name sounds familiar, that's because we mentioned Tim Pool in the first episode when we were talking about examples of propaganda and disinformation. It was used as an example because he was paid up to $400,000 a month to put out content that was from Tenet Media, which was a Russian front, basically, for Russia Today and their propaganda efforts. So just interesting. I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, that's what's basically in the White House press pool now, the style of, I can't say journalist, but point being, and who was kicked out of the press pool was Associated Press to replace with Tim Pool. So yeah, just wanted to get your guys, if you had any reactions or thoughts about that.
Yeah, definitely. Tim Pool being added and AP being ousted. It's, I don't know. Do you watch a lot of those videos of just like White House press, you know, announcements, things like that?
I don't think I seek them out, but like on Reddit, obviously, yeah, whenever something goes.
Yeah, and the way they just scream at these journalists these days and just reject the truth and fact, it's just astonishing.
I'm trying to figure it out.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. I think you're right to hesitate over the word journalist, because there is, I mean, it's not even just the Trump administration, it was the Biden administration as well, but there's been a very anti-credentialed journalist trend in the culture recently. And, you know, both parties are really, really bad about just shitting on journalists that they don't like, regardless of their credentials. I've watched so many videos in the past year or two of Matt Miller at the State Department, the spokesperson for the State Department, just disrespecting the guy from Associated Press every time he brings up these questions about Gaza and what the State Department's response is and all this stuff. And just, I mean, their last day actually was kind of crazy. There were several journalists that got dragged out of the State Department press room because they were insisting on Anthony Blinken answering for all the State Department's propaganda about the genocide that they didn't want to call it. And the State Department police are just dragging the journalists out of the press room and while they're screaming at Anthony Blinken. It's crazy. And so I just think precedent-wise, it sets up, you know, a smooth transition for an even more aggressive kind of administration like Trump's to just, you know what, fuck it, let's have this right-wing YouTuber on. Who cares if he's getting paid by some other place, you know, journalists don't matter anymore. We don't take the profession seriously. But yeah, culturally, it's big and it's kind of pervasive. People do not trust journalists and it's not good.
Always astonished by Carolina Leavitt.
That's the most recent press secretary
Press
secretary.
Yeah, yeah.
Was she the one that said something about like, I'm going to choose not to answer that unqualified? No, that was Hedzkess. He's like, someone asked like about like.
She says that kind of stuff too.
Oh, really? It's like, I'm just not going to answer that question. Like, it's not a valid question.
Yeah. And afterwards, I forget. And it's sad because there's so many of those. That's how I'm forgetting which particular one it is. But, you know, somebody presses her on some sort of propaganda and fact-based question. And she, at the end of it, just says like, oh, I even regret asking the AP press. And what are you going to believe, that? Or are you going to believe Donald Trump? It's just like, you know what? It was on tariffs. Tariffs is taxes. And she kind of explained something to an economist.
She got it right.
Right.
Like, yeah.
Watching the idiocracy come to life in real time. Yeah. It's like, you can't even laugh at it anymore. You know, it just feels like so demoralizing to see these idiots with so much power. It's so frustrating. Yeah.
I think I saw Kid Rock was in the Oval Office the other day, and he looked like he was dressed like Wayne Camacho Mountain Dew. It's just like, that would have blown my mind a couple of years ago, I think, seeing Kid Rock in there. And now it's just like another Tuesday, pretty much normalization, right, of how crazy it's become.
And he can wear whatever he wants.
Totally. Yeah.
No suit required.
Yeah, and like, wasn't Hulk Hogan like at the RNC like convention this last year? And like Terry Crews was like getting interviewed, and he was like, they did the thing that I did in the movie. They did it.
Oh, man. I think he tried to rip his shirt off at CPAC and at the RNC. Like, he's struggling with it. Like, man, that doesn't look great for you. Anyway. Yeah. I think like just the Tim Pool being added to the press pool, or not, maybe it's like someone from his podcast or his podcast network that's going to be representing there. But, you know, it just, in my mind, if you're caught or like, not even convicted, but if you are proven to be funneling propaganda for money, then maybe you shouldn't be in a press pool just in general. But I guess the direction that the Trump administration is going right now in general with their messaging, I mean, that kind of goes into the whole Greenland piece, but I don't even know if we want to talk about like that Greenland video that they had put out while J.D. Vance was visiting. I guess the only thing I'll say about that is like, when I watched it, I was like, oh, we're gonna see a lot more of this, and it's gonna be really blatant. Like, we're gonna be able to start comparing the propaganda to authoritarian regimes and actually be able to make like direct comparisons, I think, with what they're gonna start putting out. And what was more interesting than that was the group that actually paid for that ad. It was another dark money group that's, you know, funded by who knows.
Yeah, is this the video where Vance talks about, like, he's briefly there for like 3 hours and he talks about doing a, quote, Donald Trump style deal for Greenland?
I think it's a different one.
I actually not seen this video you're talking about.
Oh, so. Well, let me try and find it. So this was posted while J.D. Vance was visiting, and it was shared by J.D. Vance, it was shared by Pete Hegseth, and it was shared by Donald Trump.
In the cold silence of the tundra, a bond was born, not from treaties or trade, but from blood and bravery. While Germany controlled Europe, the Nazis set their sights on the Arctic. Greenland became an unwitting combatant, and the United States stepped in, not to conquer, but to protect. In 1943, nearly 1,000 American soldiers, with 4 chaplains, set sail from New York to Greenland, carrying with them hope, duty, and a quiet fear. But their ship was torpedoed by a Nazi U-boat, and the frigid waters of the North Atlantic became a grave. Those 4 chaplains gave up their life vests, giving their lives so that others might live, to protect America and Greenland. Their sacrifices helped win our freedom, and we will never forget. Together, Americans and Greenlanders stood as sentinels at the top of the world. But today, Greenland faces new threats from Russian aggression and Chinese expansion. Our shared legacy lives on in every joint mission, every Arctic patrol, every partnership forged in the shadow of melting ice and rising tensions. This is not just history, it is destiny. Now is the time to stand together again. For peace, for security, for the future, America stands with Greenland.
So there's that.
I really liked the line, you know, kudos to the team, you know, I guess, the propaganda machine. But the line, melting ice in rising tension.
Dang. Did they just admit global warming's real? Is that what happened there?
During one of the interviews, it was like Rubio or somebody, and he said, oh, it would be really nice to have a place that's cold if it gets warm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they've switched strategies rhetorically on climate change now. They don't really deny it anymore, but they're just like, we don't care.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned climate change. My thing I was going to point out was this concept from climate change. There's a book by a guy named Rob Nixon. He wrote a book called Slow Violence about climate change. But this concept of slow violence, of how incrementally the climate gets warmer, weather events get more and more severe, sea levels rise, droughts start, floods start, all this stuff sort of accretes slowly. And individually, it's just like one-off weather events that suck. The total overview of what's actually happening to the planet never really hits anybody because it builds so slowly and we don't really realize the violence that's happening. I was going to make the same point rhetorically about what this propaganda stuff is doing, about putting out messaging like this, which, I mean, that whole video never really pointed to a specific threat. They kind of mentioned Russia and China, but didn't say what they were doing and never really pointed out the bad guy. But the bad guy is just like lurking over the whole video. They want you to be afraid of something. And so it's just kind of normalizing this content, this fear-mongering in a way. And then specific words too, like detain and deport. When you're really talking about kidnapping people without warning, what they're doing to a lot of these students now, the ICE agents are. And it's just kind of, it's also like a psychological slow violence on the culture. The more and more this happens every single day, the more weary we get hearing about it. And it's harder to tune in and care every single day because it's just happening all the time. And what are you going to do? And so they win because they normalize it and because we become accustomed to it and we can no longer summon the will or the outrage to do anything about it. It's really, really soul-crushing what they're doing, and it's really effective. And I think we really need to focus on how scary that is power-wise.
Yeah, you mentioned language. There was that, the end statement or near the end, it's destiny, I think is what they said. It's like invoking manifest destiny. And
it's not just history. It's destiny.
Yeah.
They put history and destiny side by side like that. Yeah, that was a really interesting line.
And so I'm sure that's going to continue. That was, I just looked it up while we were talking. It's this Securing American Greatness Pack is who paid for that video and got it put out. All right. And with that, we're going to jump into part two of our episode on propaganda fascism. Please stay tuned for a word from our sponsors. Are you tired of schools teaching history that makes your children uncomfortable? Do you long for the good old days when America was never wrong? Then Patriot Education is for you. At Patriot Education, we eliminate critical thinking and focus on what really matters, memorizing only the parts of history that make America look good. Our exclusive course materials feature an 80-page textbook, because real history isn't complicated, a full chapter on how America personally defeated Hitler, and a fun activity section called Spot the Socialist. Sign up today and receive a free American flat, Beta Chi. Patriot Education, because facts should never get in the way of pride. Now we're going to talk a little bit more about like the fall of fascism, basically when the lies stopped working. The promise of fascism has always been power, absolute, unbreakable. Mussolini, Hitler, and their followers did not sell fascism as a temporary solution. They promised a rebirth, an empire, a future that would stretch beyond generations. The Third Reich was supposed to last 1,000 years. Instead, it collapsed in 12. The end of World War II was not just a military defeat for the fascist regimes, it was a collapse of their propaganda states. For years, Mussolini and Hitler had controlled the press, dictated public perception, and eliminated all dissenting voices. But propaganda only works when people believe it. And in 1945, belief was in short supply. For most of the war, Nazi Germany had maintained a carefully controlled illusion of success. German newspapers did not report on defeats. Radio broadcasts did not admit mistakes. Hitler's speeches, even as German cities burned, still promised victory. But propaganda has its limits. By 1944, even the most devoted followers of the Reich could see the truth outside their windows. You know, Germany was losing. The Allied invasion of Normandy in June 1944 marked the beginning of the final collapse. As American, British, and Soviet forces pushed into German-occupied territory, the Nazi government doubled down on its deception. Goebbels ordered state media to portray Allied advances as minor setbacks. The German people were told that Hitler had a secret plan, that super weapons were on their way, and that victory was still inevitable. In reality, Hitler had no plan, his armies were in retreat, and his officers that were once loyal to the cause were beginning to realize that their leader had led them into catastrophe. But admitting the truth was impossible. To acknowledge reality was to admit that the Reich had failed and that thousands of speeches, the endless propaganda and mass rallies and war films and slogans, it had all been a lie. This part's just interesting to me because it's the whole sunk cost fallacy of I'm so far deep into this thing that I can't for some reason admit that I was wrong, because admitting it would say that all these things I've done in the past didn't make any sense. you're still going to be known as the person that did the wrong thing. So I'm just trying to like understand the logic like the, behind that, right?
There's like a sort of juvenile masculine concept of like, it's less embarrassing to just pretend you're always right and let the consequences come. But all the while you're just insisting, no, I'm still right. I'm still right. Even when you're in jail, even when you're getting executed, I'm still right. I'm still right. That's less embarrassing than just admitting you were wrong. And which, yeah, it's a weird kind of, I think it has something to do with masculinity, honestly, this whole fascist, yeah, never admitting defeat kind of thing.
Yeah. Even with, what was it? You saw that before the election, like right before, I think it was Trump went on some news show. I can't remember what it was, but he kind of admitted that he lost in 2020. He said something to the effect of, you know, we're just there. We're so close. And oh my gosh, like the neo-Nazis revolted. There it was like Nick Fuentes was like, oh my God, you lied to us this whole time. Like, come on, man. You knew he was lying. Like, what are you talking about? Just craziness. Okay, so Mussolini's collapse came even sooner. By 1943, Italy had suffered catastrophic defeats in North Africa and Greece. The grand vision of a new Roman Empire had crumbled into disarray. Italian cities faced bombing raids, food shortages, and rising anger among the population. Fascism had promised Italy strength and stability, but it had delivered war and starvation. On July 25th, 1943, Mussolini was removed from power by his own government. The fascist Grand Council, sensing that Italy was on the brink of total destruction, turned against him. Mussolini, once the unshakable Deuce, was arrested and imprisoned. Italians who had once chanted his name in the streets now cheered his downfall. It was super interesting to me as I was reading this, but I didn't realize that Mussolini had actually been ousted from power before the war ended by his own government. And I further didn't realize that Hitler decided to go and rescue him. Hitler refused to let it go in September, so a couple months later in 1943, German forces invaded northern Italy and reinstalled Mussolini as a puppet leader of the so-called Italian Social Republic. It was little more than a Nazi-controlled occupation, and Mussolini was now a shell of the dictator he had once been, but remained in power only as long as Hitler allowed it. His own people no longer supported him, his speeches were ignored, and his promises rang hollow. Meanwhile, in Germany, the war was coming home. The Soviet Red Army had pushed into Eastern Europe, crushing German forces as they advanced. And by April 1945, Soviet troops had encircled Berlin. Hitler, hiding in his bunker beneath the city, gave his final speech to the German people. He told them to fight to the last man, never surrender, to believe in the Reich. But outside the bunker, Berlin was in ruins and no one was listening anymore. Mussolini's last days were spent running. With the war all but lost, he attempted to escape to Switzerland, hoping to flee into exile. By April 27, 1943, he was captured by Italian partisans near the town of Dongo. The next day, he and his mistress, Clara Petacci, were executed by firing squad. Their bodies were taken to Milan, where they were strung up by their ankles in Pizzala, Loreto, the very same place where Mussolini's regime had once displayed the bodies of his enemies. It was a brutal, symbolic end to fascist Italy. The leader who had demanded absolute power now reduced to a broken corpse, reviled by the people that he had once ruled. Hitler, still refusing to surrender, spent his last days in an underground Führer bunker. On April 30th, 1945, as Soviet troops advanced through Berlin, he took his own life, shooting himself in the head while his wife, Eva Braun, took cyanide. His body was burned to prevent capture, but the Reich he had built, the world he had envisioned, was already in ashes. So after he tells all the Germans to fight to the last man, he decides to kill himself.
Or did he go to Argentina?
There was a show about this with Robert De Niro, I think. It was on Amazon. But yeah, it had like Hitler still alive in the 80s in Argentina.
Oh, wow.
Running a, yeah, it was a pretty good one.
That's pretty wild that he burned his body.
You were saying that fight to the last man thing, and then he took his own life or whatever. Have you guys seen Melancholia?
No.
That movie? You haven't?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, never mind. Might be a moot point, but there's a similar parallel in Melancholia. It's like a end of the world situation. Another planet is actually crashing into planet Earth. And it's like circling around this family. The dad is like reassuring the wife. Oh, no, he's like a scientific astronomer. He's like, the calculations are perfect. It's just going to slip right by us. It'll be fine. Don't worry, yada, yada, yada. And he found that she had a bunch of pills ready to, in case, you know, it goes bad. She wanted a way out. And when he realized that it, well, do you mind if I spoil the movie? Because I kind of have to spoil
the movie. No, go for it. Crush it.
But like,
go.
When he realizes that, the earth is over, it's about to get crushed, he steals her pills and ODs, like, he runs away and kills himself and doesn't say anything to her. Just like,
they're runners.
Yeah. It's so funny. Another masculinity thing, I think. Yeah,
absolutely. All right. So with the deaths of Mussolini and Hitler, their regimes officially ended, but fascist propaganda did not disappear. In the immediate post-war years, many of the same tactics that had been used to maintain fascist rule were repurposed in new ways. In Germany, the process of denazification sought to erase Nazi ideology from public life, but many former Nazi officials remained in positions of influence. The myths of Nazi propaganda, that Germany had been betrayed, that fascism had been a noble cause, did not vanish overnight. Some persisted for decades, and you could say it did. In Spain, Franco, who had remained neutral during most of World War II, continued his fascist rule until 1975. Unlike Mussolini and Hitler, Franco did not overextend his ambitions into global war, allowing him to maintain power for decades. His propaganda machine framed him as the protector of Spain, the last great defender against communism. In the decades that followed, fascist rhetoric, the idea that strong leaders must take control, that enemies must be eliminated, and that democracy is weak and fragile, continued to appear in new forms and new places. The war had ended, but the battle over truth, over power, and over manipulation of reality through propaganda was just beginning. So something interesting here that I wanted to talk about for a second, right? We've got Italy and Germany, their leaders both died as part of the war, right? And their fascist governments kind of fell apart. And Franco just continues on until his death in 1975. So it's like the thing that stands out to me is like, if they'd never gone to, global conflict, would their regime have fallen? I don't know. I mean, they look at North Korea or some other like kind of authoritarian fascist regimes that stick to like their own country and oppressing their own people, and how often people actually interfere with that, or other countries would interfere with that if they're not invading another sovereign country. Like, it's just interesting to me.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like, maybe at the time, was war inevitable? Did they have to join their, allies in the Axis, whatever?
Just thinking about the colonial aspect of fascism and how all this plays out. And it's like, does your question is like, does fascism survive if they don't go to war or whatever? It kind of makes me think that, like, the world in general, we think the world has good people in it trying to do good things. We like to think that there are some good countries with good people in charge of them trying to protect people. But it's really like sort of like a bully in the classroom situation. If he's just picking on this one kid nobody likes and nobody really defends that kid anyway, and the bully doesn't pick on anybody else, they're probably just going to let that kid get bullied. It's only when the bully starts thinking he can pick on all these other people, he can look around the room and figure out who his next target is. And that's when people are like, we're going to put a stop to this. Right. But if you don't have any sort of colonial ambition as a fascist leader, if you're not trying to expand the empire, then people are perfectly happy to let you brutalize your own people at home. We'll just sit here and watch it. I mean, it's happening now all over the place. You could do that.
Yeah.
But until you're a threat to other big egos in the world, nobody's going to mess with you. But now we have North Korean troops in the Russian-Ukraine thing, right? So that's like, maybe North Korea is not so safe for so long if they keep, jumping in and trying to feel like they can play around in the world a little bit.
Yeah. That was actually the other piece of that was interesting to me, too, was just like, it fell after Franco died, like that the fascist, dictator Spain or Franconian Spain, because there was no one that could take it on, right? No one that like could fulfill that same role that Franco was filling. But then you brought up North Korea, and you're right, like they've maintained that dictatorship for what
three, I mean, I've at least known or been alive for three, right? Like it was, or maybe not three, I don't know, at least three generations of dictators continuing to run that country. It's just like, if you have it almost set up more like a monarchy where there's some sort of clear line of succession or like some sort of succession put in place. But most of the guys that are going to run a fascist country are too narcissistic to ever like name somebody unless it's like direct relative.
The question is, don't give them ideas.
Yeah.
You're totally right though. Monarchies seem to actually like, you know, I mean, they still exist and they kind of co-run. They don't really like the head of state. They're more of like the
mascot.
Yeah, they're the mascot for sure.
All right. So we talked about Germany and Italy and a bit of Spain all the way through World War II, but we want to look at post-World War II and kind of like into the current age, just hitting on like, well, what's going on now? There's been a rise in fascist governments or fascist-leaning governments around the world, or if you don't want to say fascist governments because they're not calling themselves fascist, that's fine. There's been a rise in authoritarian governments around the world, and I don't think that's something they would even disagree with, right? The thought of a government being run by like this strong man or a single leader that controls every aspect of that country and is considered, you know, the father of the country, like that's exactly what some of these leaders like Viktor Orban actually want. They want that to be how they're viewed as the strong man that owns and runs this country. So 1950s, we'll start around there and go to the present day, but the banners of Mussolini and Hitler have obviously been torn down, their statues defaced and their bodies discarded at this point. The world had seen in devastating detail what fascism truly was. It was not the grand empire it had promised, but a landscape of ruin and death. The Nuremberg trials laid bare the crimes of the Nazi leadership. The mass graves of the Holocaust were uncovered, and the Axis nations that had once cheered their leaders now hung their heads in shame. It seemed that fascism had been defeated, not just militarily, but ideologically. The world had learned its lesson, never again. But propaganda does not die so easily, and the methods of Mussolini, Hitler, and Franco had been too effective, too powerful to be buried alongside their regimes. Their tactics, the manipulation of truth, the crafting of enemies, the glorification of authoritarian strength, did not disappear. It evolved. While Germany underwent a process of denazification, removing overt Nazi symbols and ideology from public life, the reality was more complicated. Many of the same businessmen, officials, and military leaders who had supported Hitler remained in positions of power. In the years following the war, the West's focus shifted from fighting fascism to fighting communism. And that was an opportunity. In Spain, Francisco Franco had successfully avoided Hitler and Mussolini's fate. By staying out of World War II, he had ensured his survival. And while the world condemned fascism, Spain remained an openly authoritarian state. Franco ruled until his death in 1975, using many of the same tactics that Hitler and Mussolini had pioneered. His propaganda framed him as the protector of Spain, the only force keeping the nation from falling into communist chaos. Spanish newspapers, schoolbooks, and radio broadcasts glorified his rule, erasing opposition from the historical record. Elsewhere in Europe, fascist ideologies found new homes, often rebranded under different names. In Italy, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, founded by former supporters of Mussolini, kept fascist ideals alive, though softened for public acceptance. In Germany, neo-Nazi groups emerged in underground movements, continuing to spread revisionist history and nationalist rhetoric. The world had not rid itself of fascist propaganda, it only forced it into the shadows. If the 1930s and 40s had been dominated by fascist propaganda, the next great battle of ideology was the Cold War. The United States and Soviet Union now controlled the global narrative, each using mass media to wage psychological warfare. In America, anti-communist propaganda took on a distinctly fascist tone. The Red Scare of the 1950s, driven by Senator Joseph McCarthy, mirrored the enemy-building strategies of the Nazis and Italian fascists. Americans were told that communists lurked in the government, their schools, their neighborhoods, loyalty tests, blacklists, and show trials were common. Just as Hitler had portrayed Jews as infiltrators, McCarthyism framed communists as internal threats working to destroy the nation from within. Hollywood, which had once produced anti-fascist films during World War II, now churned out movies about communist spies and the necessity of American military strength. The idea that democracy was fragile and had to be protected by any means necessary became a common theme in Western media. Meanwhile, the Soviet Union was running its own propaganda empire. The USSR portrayed Western democracy as corrupt, decadent, and failing. Soviet newspapers censored negative news about the regime, ensuring that only state-approved narratives reached the public. The Cold War was not just a military standoff, but it was a battle of perception fought with words, images, and controlled narratives. We're definitely going to do an episode at some point on the Red Scare, like, absolutely. But just if you go and watch Oppenheimer, through the end of it, there's the whole thing. I'm not going to ruin the entire movie of Oppenheimer for anyone that hasn't seen it. But short version, if you're not familiar, of basically the premise of the movie is taking place in different flashbacks and things. But near the end of the movie, it goes into the battle over Oppenheimer's clearance and his ties to communism. He had been running the laboratory that created the nuclear bomb that ended World War II. And all of his ties to, you know, known either collaborators or sympathizers with communism were all known during this time. It was used as a weapon after the war, basically, to remove his influence and power in government. So they silenced anything that he had to say because he had actually come out a little more against, you know, some of the things that the U.S. had done during the war. So can't have scientists now telling people what to think after they create bombs for you, apparently, is the message that was sent there. Anyway, by the late 20th century, the language of fascism had changed, but its methods remained the same. Fascist movements no longer openly called themselves fascist. Instead, they adopted terms like nationalist, patriotic, or populist. But the core messaging remained identical: strong leaders, national purity, and enemies lurking within. The past was better and the future can be great. In the 1990s and early 2000s, far-right movements began gaining traction across Europe and the United States. In Russia, Vladimir Putin consolidated power using state media to erase dissent and promote a glorified image of Russian strength and tradition. In Hungary, Viktor Orban cracked down on independent journalism, portraying himself as the last defender of Europe against globalist elites. And in the United States, nationalist rhetoric took center stage. Right-wing radio hosts and television personalities rebranded fascist talking points as common-sense patriotism. Immigrants, minorities, and the media became new scapegoats. Political slogans echoed the propaganda of the past, calls to restore a golden age to defeat traitors within and bring strength back to a weakened nation. And as we look forward, you know, the internet obviously changed everything. Where once propaganda had been controlled by governments and media barons, now anyone could spread a message. The rise of social media, viral misinformation, and algorithm-driven news feeds created the perfect environment for fascist ideas to spread. In the 2010s, far-right movements embraced memes and viral content as propaganda tools. Online communities like 4chan and Reddit became hubs for nationalist messaging, using humor to normalize extreme ideologies. The rise of disinformation campaigns, often supported by state actors, blur the lines between reality and fiction. Russian-backed troll farms flooded social media and fake news, conspiracy theories, and nationalist rhetoric. Leaders who embraced these tactics, from Donald Trump to Jair Bolsonaro, relied on social media to bypass traditional media and speak directly to their followers. In the modern era, fascist propaganda no longer needs a ministry of information. It's decentralized, crowdsourced, and global. Some warning signs of fascist propaganda today. You know, it always follows a similar pattern. The only difference is really how it's going to be delivered. When a leader is claiming that the golden age was stolen from a nation or a specific group is to blame, the free press is the enemy, or only they can fix things, the warning signs are flashing. Fascism has never needed swastikas or black shirts. All it needs is a population that stops questioning, that believes the leader is above the law, and that sees the opposition as treason. So fascism never dies, you know, it retreats and it's adapting. The regimes of Mussolini and Hitler collapse under the weight of their own lies, but their propaganda techniques, you know, the rewriting of history, the manufacturing of enemies, and the glorification of a strong leader survived. Their lessons were studied, repackaged, and used by new leaders in new forms and new technologies. The tools of propaganda that once required government-run newspapers and state-controlled radio stations now fit in a tweet, a meme, a 30-second TikTok video. The control once exerted through censorship and military suppression is now reinforced through algorithm-driven echo chambers and disinformation networks. If the 20th century was a battle for control of the airwaves, the 21st century is a battle for control of attention. And fascism thrives on distraction. It thrives when people believe simple answers to complex problems. It thrives when people are told they are victims and that only one leader, one movement can restore what was lost. It thrives when the press is labeled as the enemy of the people. It thrives when protesters are called terrorists. And it thrives when truth becomes subjective. The promise of fascism has always been the same, a golden past that can be restored, that a great betrayal can be avenged, that a nation's enemies, foreign and domestic, can be eliminated. But the reality of fascism is always the same too. You know, war, economic ruin, and the silencing of all those who dare to question. If history has taught us anything, it's that propaganda is not just a relic of the past. It is a weapon, a system of control, a way to manipulate perception itself. Is it still being used today, right now? This isn't really a question. It's very clear that this is being used today and now. But yeah, the final truth of fascist propaganda is that it only works if people stop asking questions.
Please stay tuned for a word from our sponsors.
Are you tired of working a dead-end job?
Are you drowning in bills? Wondering if the American dream was a lie?
Man, you're speaking my language.
And it's time to take control of your financial future with Patriot Bet.
Wait, how does gambling online help my finances?
Because when you bet big, you win big. And the only real risk is not playing at all.
But what if I lose?
Losers quit. Winners double down.
Patriot Bet is not a financial planning service. Losses may exceed savings. Gambling addiction support may be available, but why would you need that if you're winning?
So what do you guys think? Do you think it was anything that was new to you guys, or was it most of it just kind of a recap?
I like the ending, and I think it really correlates well with Joe's metaphor of it being like a bully in the room, because the people, we can all just go to town on that bully.
Yeah.
We all reject the bully.
No, I like it.
I felt like a lot of it was new. Or for me anyway, like I'm not like a World War II buff, so I don't know all the details, especially all the Mussolini stuff. I was just learning a lot listening to that. I thought the little anecdote about how, you know, Mussolini got arrested and taken prisoner and everything, and then Hitler was like, wait a minute, I need my guy in Italy. So went down there to prop him back up. Like, I don't know. I thought that was funny. I never really had known that history, so it was interesting. Yeah, I wonder if like similar dynamics between people today, Trump, Putin, Bolsonaro, Narendra Modi in India, like there are a bunch of little fascist figures on the landscape today, and it'll be kind of terrifying, but in another way also interesting for people like us who are trying to like figure out how all this stuff works and figure out how to question it, what's the most useful way to question it. It'll be interesting to study the social dynamic between all the wannabe fascists today. You know, the people who are trying to cling and hold on to their power, not only do they kind of need each other rhetorically because they're spreading a similar kind of message, but at the same time, they can't help but compete with one another. They can't help but, you know, they all, it's kind of a measuring contest at a certain point, like who's actually daddy in this situation. I don't know. Yeah. That'll be kind of interesting to watch and scary, obviously, with lots of consequences for lots of people.
Yeah. That's like what's going on right now in Ukraine with this whole back and forth where we're now like negotiating with Russia and keeping Ukraine out of the room. And then we've got this mineral deal that they want to pull with Ukraine. But at the same time, Russia's like, oh, yeah, we'll do that for you just with our portion of Ukraine. We'll just end the war and then you can have all the minerals you want. That's really the realignment is scary. And there was, I can't remember who said this. I think it was one of the right-wing pundits or influencers, not Matt Walsh, but one of those guys, like came out before the election, was like, I think we need a Viktor Orban style strongman to lead our government. Like, so it's a full acknowledgement of what they are and still saying this is what we need and normalizing that as being the government that they think the United States should have, that we should have a more authoritarian dictatorship-like government and be okay with that, which is just crazy to me.
like we were mentioning earlier with the sort of desperation in the people that creates the conditions for fascism to thrive. There's a lot of like mental exhaustion that goes along with that with the average person. And you can sort of see it, especially with some of these shows. Like I think the guy from The Daily Show or one of the guys from The Daily Show will go to Trump rallies and interview people all the time and just sort of stand in the line and ask them questions and stuff. And you can hear it in some of their responses sometimes when he tries to get them to be specific about Trump's plan. Like I remember leading up to the election, he was asking him, you know, like, what is Trump going to do that's going to make everything better all of a sudden? And this one lady was just like, just trust that he has a plan. Just trust that he has a plan. And there's just this willingness to just give up the analysis because it is messy. It is complicated. It is exhausting to think about. And it's nice to think that somebody out there is just going to take care of it all, you know? And that's part of what they depend on, too, is people being too just deadbeat, exhausted, and annoyed and frustrated to even care about analyzing it. The questioning itself becomes a burden for people. You can feel it, like, emotionally in a lot of...
Yeah. And you just want it to be true.
Yeah.
Sure. I'm sure everyone just really wanted cheaper prices, like, to control inflation, to be able to provide for their family and live their life, right? Like, I feel like that's the majority of people. I think the last thing that came up in my news feed was Steve Bannon was out talking about like how they're looking into options to enable a third term for Trump. And so NBC News asked him about it. Yeah, he basically said like there are methods for seeking a third term. And it was the same thing that like Bannon had said, like we're looking into ways that this could happen. It's just this general like, oh, we think that there's a possibility here. But a lot of people, I'm using the Trump language, all the people, every people say. But I've seen a lot of comments or analysis online that talks about Trump talking about a third term as a way to cover for some of the other things that he's doing. But from the episodes actually that we're listening to right now with the fascism episode, one of the key tenets is to keep repeating something over and over and over again, regardless of the truth of it, because it just makes it normalizes. It makes people think about it, makes people talk about it more. And so like it's clearly a tactic. It's not, in my mind, just a distraction. It's a tactic to normalize this so that when he does seek a third term somehow, it doesn't seem as insane because people are having those reactions to it now. But yeah, wanted to get your guys' thoughts. The two things he said, there are methods and he's not joking about a third term. So everyone that said he'll never do that and he was never really, you know, they're not joking.
They'll still be saying it if he does do it. They'll be, oh, no. I mean, it's against the Constitution. And that's it. End of discussion. Should not be. Why not just transfer the power like every other president? Pick a successor or somebody who has the same values as your party that you want to continue. It doesn't need to be him. Putin put in, you know, it doesn't need to be anybody.
I guess that's one of the things that he was saying was like the Putin route of maybe J.D. Vance runs and I run as the vice president and then I'll just take over.
Wow. Yeah.
That's also illegal.
And to like echo your point too, it is exactly his playbook. He at first was tripping the whole Canada 51st state thing. Then he's joking. Then he's not joking. The tariffs, I'm not joking. And then all of a sudden it's reality. He's just, yes, testing the waters until it's normalized.
Part of me is like surprised when people are surprised that he wants a third term. Like, did you not see this coming?
Right.
Like, but also, I don't know, part of me had the understanding with this last election, like the ruse is up. We were doing a really good job pretending we were a democracy for a while, but the ruse is up. This is not legitimate in any way. And there's nothing we can do about it because they're at the wheel. They got the power. I don't know. People are like, oh, we can stick it out for 4 years and then we'll elect. What do you mean stick it out for 4 years? They're not going away. They're never planning on going away. Once they get the power, they don't just give it up. They're going to, like they said, find methods. Whatever methods end up being, probably guns. Yeah, we shouldn't have gave them the keys in the first place, you know?
Yeah, definitely. And also, like, the I feel like if you know, conspiratorially, you could say that there are several people in the administration that risk jail/prison for life. And that would be a giant motivating factor for me to maintain cheap power if I were some authoritarian regime. And I think that they're thinking the exact same thing. Elon has been quoted saying that he was going to go to jail if Trump didn't win.
It's a very standard, like, fascist dictator playbook. You can point out, like, all the maneuvers Putin's done to stay in power and not give it up. And the same thing with, like, someone like Netanyahu, like, who routinely sabotages any and all ceasefire deals that happen because he's so unpopular in his country, they can't wait to get rid of him.
I mean,
but as long as he maintains this war, as long as he maintains this commander-in-chief urgent situation happening right now bullshit, like, he gets to stay. So, like, they'll do whatever they need to do, start a war, throw tariffs out there, you know, just actually murder people. They'll do whatever they want.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that people are surprised at how fast everything's moving, and I don't think it's quite sunk in for everyone. The reason everything's moving so fast and the reason everything is chaos every day is because the moment that they won, that was the peak of their power, unless they took more. Like, so they have to continually take more and continue to push and continue to push the envelope of what is acceptable in order to continue to grow their power. Like, so there's no slowing down. If they slow down, who knows, maybe then there's weakness there in their minds or something. But Joe, the thing you said about Netanyahu, like, that guy was convicted before Trump was. And so I always wonder if Israel's a better example of what the U.S. is sliding into right now than Russia, right? Like, I mean, maybe it's a combo of both, like with what happened to Russia after this fall of the Soviet Union. But yeah, I mean, follow Netanyahu, his path, and then look at Trump, and it's pretty similar, the route that they're taking or have taken so far.
Yeah, I mean, they're already openly collaborating on their Gaza genocide remodeling project. Like, the IDF dropped these leaflets over Gaza that had, like, printed out, like, we're going to do Trump's plan. Like, they're openly admitting this collaboration in public now, and it's just, like, mask off, no hiding, this is who we are. And it's the ultimate flinch test for any resistance that's out there. Like, we're doing it now. Are you going to do something about it or not? We're doing it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Netanyahu, internationally wanted war criminal by the ICC. Just buddy-buddy with our guy.
So with that in mind, everyone's got to do something.
Right.
Before we go for today, I did want to take a moment to talk about a few things that are happening in my general area that might be interesting to people. It's kind of aligned to what we've been talking about and the values that we have on this podcast. I am going to do a quick disclaimer and say, you know, what these events, I don't know the people that are putting these events on. You know, I found these online, but they seem pretty interesting. So I just wanted to highlight a couple things that are going on in the local area. One thing is happening on Tuesday, April 15th. There's going to be an event in Keysville, New York, called One Small Step in Keysville, Skills to Bridge the Political Divide. The description for this event, it's a free event, and it says you can come and learn how to bridge the political divide by guiding people through conversations that seek common ground and elevate the humanity in one another. This goes from 5:30 to 7 p.m. Like I mentioned, it's free. They're going to have pizza. You do need to register to reserve your spot. So if you Google One Small Step in Keysville, Skills to Bridge the Political Divide, that should come up in Eventbrite, and you should be able to register there. The other one that I want to mention, on Sunday, April 27th, there is a Climate Action Collective networking night in Burlington, Vermont, from 5 to 7 p.m. It's the Climate Action Collective. It's a multi-collegiate group based in Burlington, Vermont, sponsored by 350VT. It's a student-led grassroots climate action group, and it's a networking event that they're going to have that night. So, again, if you Google that, you should be able to find it in Burlington and register. It's free if you're interested in joining either one of those events. Joe, Arthur, anything in your area that you want to highlight? I know that there's a ton of protests going on this weekend, but unfortunately, this episode's going to come out after the April 5th protest.
Yeah, that's the only thing. I went through we have the weekly, or as every place does, you know, weekly magazine, but there wasn't anything political in there. They did highlight that on the 5th, you know, people were meeting up. That was it.
Yeah, a lot of mobilization on the 5th. It coincides with a national march for Palestine. I went to the one in 2023. It was in November. There was like 500,000 people there. It was the craziest, biggest protest I've ever seen. It was really awesome. Hopefully this Saturday will also be huge. There are a lot of anti-Trump groups and a lot of anti-genocide groups and a lot of different conversations sort of showing up and commingling together. So it'll be really interesting to see all of these different elements of resistance to what we might say are the big bad things in the world coming together, what opportunities for conversations will take place. That'll be really interesting on Saturday. I haven't decided where slash when slash if I'm going to go on Saturday, but chance I'll probably go because I'm close enough and I should. I was going to say something I'm doing on next Thursday, April the 10th. There's a journalist I follow, Ryan Grimm, who works with Dropsite News, and they purchased 535 copies of this poem written by a Palestinian poet, Rafit al-Alir. He wrote a poem called If I Must Die. And I think when I do the Gaza episode, I'll probably read that poem and talk about him a little bit. But he was killed in a couple of months after all this started in 2023. And so his poem kind of went viral after he died because he sort of anticipated the circumstances of that happening and narrated it like as a poet. And so this journalist group purchased a copy for every member of Congress. So I volunteered to show up on next Thursday and help them distribute these poems to the members of Congress. So kind of excited about that. Nice. I don't know how that'll go, but definitely let y'all know.
Yeah.
Interesting to talk about.
Yeah. I'm excited to hear about that. Yeah. For our next episode.
Well, cool.
Awesome. Well, thanks everyone for tuning in.
That's it for this week. Stay informed, not influenced. And remember, propaganda loves you.